Thank you, Lizzie, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. I want to share with everyone tonight something that's a detective story that has been playing out over a couple hundred years, and also something that's been personal to me. Every time that things have been difficult in my life, I'd somehow shut it out and I'd pick up this detective story and try to find the next chapter. And Baruch Hashem, I've been successful. On this topic, as you're going to see, there were a lot of dead ends and a lot of areas where people have thought they came to the final conclusion, and then it turns out that there's more to the story. So I want to share the journey with you as much as where we end up. So the journey was actually half of the fun. I published this article in the Sfarim blog about a year ago, about 10 months ago. And there's been a really good response to it, over 9,000 views, and a lot of comments, and a lot of good comments. And only some of those views were actually from me. Most of them weren't. And actually, somebody wrote an anti-article, which some people were, you know, called me up. But what are you going to do? I was really excited. Yes, absolutely. So I want to share with you what this is all about, and I want to take you on my journey. So the title, people have asked me, what's a porger? And I've never heard that word before. Is it a Scrabble word? The answer is yeah. It's actually an English word. And it's very shocking because every word that I could think of, I challenge anyone to come up with a different word that has to do with halacha specifically, is either Hebrew or Yiddish. I can't think of an actual word that I've tried that it has to do with halacha specifically that is not in the English dictionary that's not either Hebrew or in origination or in Yiddish. So the Hebrew word for mikra hagid is mikra, menaker. The Yiddish word is triber. Porge is actually in the English dictionary. It's in the Oxford English Dictionary and the Merriam-Webster. And the etymology of the word is from Middle English, relating to purge. So the idea of purging is taking something that is not that you don't want and getting rid of it, right? So purging something is purging developed from that Middle English word. In the Oxford English Dictionary, there's another potential etymology of French, Middle French, from jeter, which means to throw. And that would actually be a wonderful name for a New York Yankee shortstop. So I want to start as follows. The Crazy Placey is a classic halakha sefer. And the only sefer printed in the lifetime of Rabbi Snaibishitz. It was published in 1763, where Rabbi Snaibishitz lived, in Altoona. There were three communities. He was the rav of the three communities. They were close together. It was known as Aleph Hei Vav Ahu, Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. And they were in the Kingdom of Denmark. Now, Rabbi Snaibishitz lived there from approximately the late 1750s until his death in 1764. The great controversies did follow him there. He was considered by some in Prague to be a closet Shabbatian. Rabbi Oppenheim refused to allow him to become the Rav after him, Rabbi Oppenheim. And he became a rav in Metz, where there was more allegations, and then he ended up in becoming the rav in Altoona, which happens to be the hometown of Yaakov Emden. So it was kind of strange why he ended up there. And he was actually the rav, and in fact, he had more supporters there. And in fact, Yaakov Emden had to leave because of this. But in his Hakdama to this Sefer, which was the only Sefer printed in his lifetime, he says that because of the controversy, he was not able to publish any Sfarim. And he writes the names of the Sfarim that he has written that haven't been published. And today, of course, all of them are classic Sfarim that are in, you know, almost every shul, such as the Tumen, which is used in yeshivas, in Hilchos Kesher Mishpat, such as Ne'ahuva on Navi, such as Krasi, which is published here, which is a classic halacha sefer, which is used, such as Yaros Dvash, which is a classic of Drush. So in this Krasi Uplasi, and the reason why it's important that he was alive at the time it was published is because, as we're going to see, you know, something that was published after a person's lifetime has a certain lower level of standard of responsibility. You know, the classical thoughts, and I actually have in my collection, and you can see it around, is a Chavetz Chaim that every sefer he would sell of Mishabrua, he would personally sell, he'd go through it, and he'd write Magar in the front that he went through it, and it's not missing pages, and it's not pages aren't stuck together, and it's of good quality. You'd think that that standard would apply. So again, when it comes to a responsibility for what's written, something that's printed posthumously is definitely going to have a lower standard, whereas something printed during the lifetime of the person will have a higher standard. And we're going to see why that comes into play. So in Siman Samach Hei, where he addresses the issue of Gid Hanasha, which is the Gid that cannot be eaten, or displaced Gid, if you want to get art scroll on me, he says as follows, V'hine, v'zmani, in my time, ha'yem menaker echad, there was a menaker, someone that was that actually did niker, which we don't generally do today, because we've gotten wealthier and we have going to buy the back parts. It's on the right side. Even a bal teira and a mumchel ma'ayid. I mean, this is high praise from Rav Yitzchak Eibishitz, who was acknowledged to be a master halachist. And Master Talmud Chacham, and certainly in this particular field, he was universally acknowledged as the leading Pesach relating to issues of Avisa V'Heter, including Gid Hanasha. And there was this expert, again, by the testimony of Rav Yitzchak Eibishitz, that a different Gid is the correct Gid. So that halacha is you have to remove the Gid Hanasha. And the gid that was being removed is not the correct gid. And the gid that needs to be removed is a different one. Ba'ad hayoyim hazeh, until this day, te'inu. Next page, one second. Nachnu v'aviseinu begid she'ena gid she'oisra ha'tayra. And we are taking out the gid that the Torah does not require to take out. V'hi haylech, and he went, the shav, and came back. He went back and forth. I mean, that's the language. V'chol eretz Ashkenaz, in the entire land of Ashkenaz. Now, again, traveling from LA to New York, you know, it was a 6-hour flight. You know, not that big a deal. You know, they didn't have shocks and springs back then. And the roads aren't exactly that great. So this man was determined. So you have a Talmud Chacham who was quite determined, and he went back and forth in the entire land of Ashkenaz, Umarish Habriyos, and he made everyone a rash. He made noise. He accomplished. You know, people were concerned. Actually, Bala Prague, until he came to Prague. Okay. So Prague is actually on the easternmost side of Ashkenazi Kehillas. So he was causing some issues. Yitzia Dvarav, and he proposed what he was saying, in front of me, okay? And he explained, he came in front of the Gainim and he explained his position. And I looked into the issue. This gid, the gid that he is pointing to, Einoi rak b'behemes charem. This gid that he is talking about is only by behemes charem, which leads one to believe that it is the gid of the Zachars, but it doesn't, that would appear to be, as some understood. V'loi b'behemes nekeves. So this gid is by behemes charem and not by behemes nekeves. Okay, so this man is a Talmud Chacham, he's a mumcha, he's and he's been really putting in effort, okay, traveling around and causing, making noise. And Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz shows him a smag. A smag. Smag stands for Sefer Mitzvahs Gedolos. Shekasvu Degid Hanasha Noyig B'Zchar V'Nekevis. That the Gid Hanasha is Noyig by Zecharim V'Nekevis. Al Yidei Kach Ishtakel Miluloi Akapanim Eilas Mechunik Benikas Kim Al Baki V'Yeres Hashem. Okay, and this expert stopped. He accepted it, and he stopped his agitation. So, here is the problem with this, okay? The problem with this is that there is no such smag. No, making the problem even worse, that it's not that there is no such smag, which is true. So they understood it to mean like that the Sefer HaMitzvahs followed the format of the Chinuch. It doesn't, but that's what the Poskim who came after this and asked assume. And they asked the question in the following way, which is that if on a mitzvah's leis haseh, right, is noyeg, is language of the Chinuch. The Zechar ben Akevis, Cholmokam ben Cholzman, right? Like all mitzvahs leis haseh. It's incumbent upon male and females, like all mitzvahs leis haseh. Now, it's incumbent upon male and females, people or animals?
We don't eat people.
What?
We don't eat people.
Right. So it's obvious that it's talking about it's incumbent upon male and female people to not eat Gid Hanasha. So you think about what he's saying. He's saying that I showed him, it says Chermin Gavis right there. But we're not, but that means people, right? Because as you said, you don't eat people.
They should copy of the skin, not the skin.
Understood. But think about what he's trying to say, therefore. He's trying to say that because it's incumbent upon people, men and female people, to not eat Gid Hanasha, therefore, the Gid has to be. On the male animal and not the female animal. Right. So he's making a mistake, a terrible mistake. He's saying that Schar Mekavis is referring to animals and not to people, when it obviously is referring to people. Okay. So this question is like, you know, yeah, people can make a mistake, but it's almost as if. It's a mistake of a conservative rabbi. He just can't read. And I don't want to say this, like that, but it's actually true. There were, following subsequent to this, there were maskilic books that used this mistake to say, you know, the rabbis really don't know anything. They can't determine between people, animals, it's all the same to them. And this was a question that was dealt with by Chassam Sofer, by Shlomo Kluger, and a number of others. And it's a real problem. I just want to recap that the real problem here is that that he fundamentally misunderstands the concept. When it says Naig Mishkar Menikevis, it's talking about it's Naig Mishkar Menikevis people, and it's not talking about Naig Mishkar Menikevis animals. And he seems to be saying that it's Naig Mishkar Menikevis is referring to animals, which it can't mean.
What? Wouldn't say like it's an animal. You touch it, you found an animal. You don't say you found in people. That's why they're like it.
Yeah, but the Torah itself, if the
Yaakov would say, I'll kill you with Bnei Yisrael, and everybody.
Okay, we'll see about Bnei Yisrael. We'll see about Bnei Yisrael, if Bnei Yisrael means Bnei Yisrael like Bnei Yisrael. Because we do find sometimes that there are such limudim like that. We'll get to that in a second. Okay. So,
where did you see this? If it's not in the smoke,
okay, we'll get to that. So, what's funny about this is that the mistakes keep on piling up. The Chassam Sofer is the great one to ask this question, and he understands it to be the way I just explained it to you. And only later do people say, even on Chassam Sofer, that hey, wait a second, there is even no such smoke. Okay, so the smoke doesn't mean to say anything. So we'll get to that in a moment. So let's just Look at what the Chassam Sofer has. So, Toldos Adam. Toldos Adam, this is actually, again, really fascinating. So there was someone by the name of Yecheskel Feivel. He was known as the Maggid of Vilna. And he wrote Toldos Adam on the Zalman, the brother of Chaim Volozhin. You'd think this would be a really from Sefer. And in fact, T.V. Eger quotes from it, and various people quote from it. But almost immediately, the Gedolim that had a little more knowledge of what's going on, such as the Meretz Chiyus, they point out that he directly copied from Mendelssohn. So a lot of Toldos Adam is straight out of Mendelssohn. And his other Talmud, Wasseli. Okay? So what's interesting about it is that the Meretz Chiyus' problem with this is that it's a lot of it is taken without
permission.
What?
Credit.
Without credit, which is also known as plagiarism. The more frum didn't really care so much about the plagiarism, such as the Minchas Elazar. They cared more about from who he plagiarized. He was okay with it being plagiarized, but she didn't like it being plagiarized to Mendelssohn. So it's actually quite funny. But in this Sefer, Toldos Adam, he basically says it's a mistake. So he says, let's go. I decided, right? Maybe he was referring to the smak instead of the smak. Kimarnu ulay mishkev tay sefer hu. It's a tay sefer. Smag makim smak. Sefer mitzvah tanis, different sefer. Gam sham lehunach lanu kilo yizkev lepokek shama imi yizkarim mekavis bedinza lemanonu libenim levakish misifrei apayskim migir rabba. He worked very hard on this. Chipush rav. Avol kasher lachnu came banu yaganu lematzanu lashem zegir hanasha noy gehem yizkarim mekavis. And he says it's a mistake, and everyone should learn a kavu chayim from themselves to themselves. That if Nisa Abishitz can make such a mistake, then you should also be cognizant that you could potentially make such a mistake yourself. But his conclusion is that it's a mistake. There's some sefer in Shuvah Samach Pes, which I can make larger.
Control plus.
There we go. And I did it. Second. Okay. So here goes. Mashakasu Bakrasi. Saif Simon Samache Shimanakar Echad. Here is Sha'ilam. Shigiranash Yigir Echad. Shani Nimsa Elbu Behemis Kharm Lubin Kavis. Laimotsuchachmi Prag Mane. They didn't have what to answer. Acha going bald placey. Here lay the smag. Shakasu Mitzis Ganash. So here's actually the problem that I have. Okay. I wanted to get to my analysis of this, but we'll talk about some cipher. My analysis is bringing it out is I don't understand how a man who is a Talmud Chacham, who is an expert, who has been driving around with his horse and buggy, the Artis Ashkenaz, this must have taken him months, how he possibly was satisfied with a non-existent smak. I showed him something that didn't exist and he was fine with it. How did that happen?
I'm assuming it has to do more with politeness. Meaning, okay, Rav Yosef, I actually said something I'm not going to contradict. Unless you believe he would anyway. I'm saying.
I mean, he's been going around. He's an expert. He's a Talmud Chacham.
There's also all the guidance that Rav Yosef said. Akashis was with, though also...
But he didn't say, you know, I showed up and he got scared. He said, I showed up and I had to show him a source. So I'm saying, why is he happy with the source?
Are there other instances of Sakharib and Nikitas as opposed to Anashim and Nashim? Like, we see that?
Only the Lushin of isn't the Chinuch that uses that. That kind of Lushin. Right. That's his
right.
Lushin. And right here we have Cheskel Feivel, who says that he searched. Now the question is whether he searched or Moses Mendelssohn searched. Because we don't know. Now again, it's hard to say, but again, others have said this before me. But it could be that's where the Maskilim got this from, because, you know, okay, fine. Rabim Tamu al Shigig Gdaila Shiyatza Nashalitim. There's a lesson in the Gemara, the Gemara uses it, so it's actually a pasuk. Keshkaga Yetzim in Pnei Ashalit. That sometimes, a tzaddik or a great person says something that he doesn't mean, it happens anyway. So that's what he's referring to. And it's interesting because some Sefer talks about it in a letter. It's an unbelievable letter. Mekiva Eger wrote him a letter of asking him some questions, talking and learning, asking him some questions about Hilchos Avelos. And some Sefer's letter back, and it's an incredible letter. But his letter back, he writes, and it's published, he writes that because you wrote me about Hilchos Avelos, my mother died. Whoa. And I'm caught a machbin on this, and it's like Kishgaga Hayetzer Pia Shalit. He actually uses that pasuk. So, I mean, I don't know, because I was taught that Torah is Torah. You know, you have to learn it, you have to know it. I don't think that Sefer meant to reproach the Kiveger, but it's what he writes. So, okay, yeah, the Rabbi Tamal Shugah Gedela Shiatzam Hashalitim, the Smag Mairi. It's unbelievable. As he's saying the Shkaga Hayetzim Hashalitim, he's making a Shkaga too. It's also a terrible Shkaga because the Smag. He's saying what the Smag is talking about, but as we all know, the Smag isn't talking about it because there is no such Smag. It's maybe a chinuch, right? The smag mari sheinoyeg v'sfarim Yisraelim in the kevus kedarke b'chol ha-mitzvahs. But again, he never uses that lashon. It's not the lashon of the smag. So the Chasam Sofer is making also a big tayas here. It's just proof that nobody learned the smag. That's all it's proof of.
How? The Chasam Sofer wouldn't. I'm just trying to understand. Meaning, how does everybody say it's a mistake, but they never sold the smag itself? Back then, they just didn't have copies of the smag, maybe? Or?
No, they had the smag. He was the morning.
They didn't have the smag.
I'm saying he's obviously making an assumption. Here's the assumption he's making. Everyone knows the chinuch. They assume that the other sifrei mitzvahs follow the same format. Mm-hmm. That's the assumption. But the truth is, they don't. And the truth is, it's not there.
Right.
I mean, I could have brought it up. I just don't have it on. They don't have the smag on.
How do we know that the smag was a false?
Oh. Okay, so that is what Shlomo Kugler says. He says that maybe there was such a smag and it was lost. Okay, however, today, when you do have lots of copies of manuscripts and you have all that information, it's not there. Okay, so the Rabim Tamul Shigag Dailish Yatsam Ashalitim, the smag Mairi, the non existent smag is talking about. Okay, so what he was trying to say is that I will now say that Rabbi Yonasan Avishitz is correct. Okay, and he meant what he said, and he said what he meant. And there is no mistake, and this is how it goes. V'ani oimer, divrei chachamim kayomen, d'harei, yesh lachar kivon, d'kaimon b'nei Yisrael v'loi b'nei Yisrael. There is a miut of b'nei Yisrael v'loi b'nei Yisrael. Okay, I'll cut off like you the Rabbi Yossi, I'll smooch is Rishus or Esli Lissler. I will call you out my name, Darshi Bonnet, Bene, Blebnois. When Kasha, get a Nasha, Nami, and my name, Bene Sof and Esli Strong. It says by exactly as you pointed out, it says by Gid HaNasha B'nei Yisrael. So how come we don't find in the Gemara there's a drasha of B'nei Yisrael of Le'B'nei Yisrael, right? And therefore it would be V'nei Gid HaNasha B'nei Kev Yisrael. So the question is why if it says that of B'nei Yisrael, there isn't such a drasha of B'nei Yisrael of B'nei Yisrael. And we do find by Tuma, by Kehanim, it says Dabar of B'nei Yisrael. And it doesn't say, and in there we do make a mir of Bnei Yisrael of Bnei Yisrael. Yeah. Yesh liyashiv, but yeshiv ken el b'kum v'aseh. We only make that drosha by b'kum v'aseh. Avon l'leis aseh, hishva akasav ishu l'ish, v'kol enshin shivetarim. And therefore, by l'leis aseh, it should never make a difference. Ah. Avon tzinu gam b'leis aseh, emar l'kehanim b'nei Aaron. B'le b'nei Aaron, shemetam l'meisim, ha'afiu b'leis aseh, matin nashim, min kein, g'nei nashim nami, amai noig v'schoyim in kevis, v'tzarim chlemer, shiny, gabe kehanim, So what he's saying is when there's a reason to be mechalek women and men, right? Then we do make a chiluk and make the drasha of bnei v'le b'nais. Why is there a chiluk by tuma of kehanim by men and women? Because kehanim have to do avoida, and since they can't do avoida with tuma, so maybe you can't become tameh. Whereas a woman, she never has to avoid them. So maybe she could become tamei, right? So there's a reason to separate the men and the women in there. So therefore, we do make a drasha of bnei v'leh b'nois. Okay? So let's analyze, let's apply this analysis to Gid HaNasha. The Hashta, as you pointed out,
Avi
pointed out that Yaakov was the one who was fighting with the Malach, and Al came Yechu Bnei Yisrael Gid HaNasha Arayim Azeh, and therefore it was a man fighting, and if it would have been a woman fighting, maybe the woman only would have not had to eat would have not been allowed to eat the Gid HaNasha. But therefore, there's a reason to be mechalek between men and women, and therefore the fact that it's noyig by women people. Means that it's a proof that it's knowing by all animals, because there's no reason to split the women from the men. Because you would think that if it would only by male people, then it would also be only by male animals. Okay, that is the Chassam Sofer. The Shlomo Kluger doesn't like this, and he says, oh man, we have to get moving. Okay, sorry. We have to get moving because we got to get moving. I didn't realize how much time this is taking. Okay, let's talk about the final answer. The final answer came about, the almost final answer. So in the 1920s, there was a sefer called the Pardes Yosef, which is in the Moschels, okay? And in it, he brings this whole controversy, and he brings some cipher, and he brings the Shlomo Kluger, he brings everyone. He says, however, in the 1938 volume of Ha Pardes, which is a journal printed out of Chicago, there was an article from a Rabbi Nefes from Los Angeles, and he actually writes Los Angeles. It's unbelievable. Pre-war cipher printed in the 1930s by a Polish gadol, says Los Angeles in it. And he says that Arminius and Eibishitz had his own personal copy of Crazy Placey. And in his own personal copy of Crazy Placey, he crossed out Smag and he replaced it with Seder Hilchas Mikra, another Sefer. Okay? Now, this answer is great because it bypasses all problems. No major chidushim, it's just a printer's mistake. Sefer Hilchos Nikur is a specialist sefer. There is no exact sefer by that name. We'll get to that in a moment. But it's a specialist sefer, and he didn't make a mistake, and he fixed it himself. And the printer of this sefer was not Rabbi Yenis Nadishitz himself. And as we can see, that, and I put here some pictures, that yes, Rabbeinu Ivershitz was the author, and yes, it was published in his lifetime, but on the side, throughout the Sefer, there are many, many, many of these types of comments. Some of the comments are he's asking a question on the Tesef, or he's answering a question on the Rosh. But some of them are almost like the type you get in P1A. Good answer, 5-star answer. And one of this one, it says, Yishev Nachum v'tam Hagun. Great answer, well reasoned. It's not possible that the writer himself would put this on it, right? It just doesn't make sense, right? So therefore, someone else prepared it for publishing. It was a Rashi Tevis that he didn't understand. It was a Sefer that he thought he knew. He was probably a Talmud Chacham. I'm sure it was a Talmud Chacham. But this was a specialist Sefer. And therefore, he went ahead and put Smag, when really it was Seder Hilchas Mikur. When Abiyaz and Ivishit saw the printing mistake, he crossed it out and changed it in his own volume. Very Gishmak and Teretz. And Shlomo Michal Neches says that he has this crazy place in his possession. And everyone loved this answer. It's a great answer. It makes a lot of sense. It puts Rabbeinu Ivershitz in a much better light. And everyone wants it to be true. So when I came to Los Angeles, one of the projects I had was to find this crazy place. So this is Rabbi Neches. Okay. Now, there was always a lot of controversy about Rabbi Neches, as we'll see with this statement that he made. So he published this article, and people were saying that, you know, can he be relied upon? I don't know. I don't know if that picture is the best picture of someone that you want to rely on. Now, there's also the fact that he was the rabbi of such stellar balabatim as Larry Mullen Curley. and Harry Houdini when he lived in Los Angeles. So, you know, he was a born in Yerushalayim, and he did grow up in Yerushalayim, in a golden guy. He moved to Los Angeles to raise money. He saw it was good and he stayed. Rabbi Dunner of Los Angeles, who's a historian, doesn't have the highest valuation of him. But when I came to Los Angeles, I wanted to find this crazy place that is quoted by the Pardes Yosef, and which Rabbi Neches had in his possession. And it would make sense that he would have it in Los Angeles because that's where he lived. And I went to track down his collection. It had been sold in different places. And I made a breakthrough in a place called American Jewish University. It's so sad. They're on this 100-acre campus in Malibu. It's magnificent. It's worth billions of dollars. And just the land. And there's this, you know, it's conservative, it's reform. And they have these sfarim, and there's absolutely nobody that looks at it. And the librarian is like, great, you can read Hebrew? Can you help me out here? And yeah, I said, I wanted to look at some sfarim. He goes, oh, you came for our army Talmud. I'm like, what do you do? They have their star of their show is this Talmud, this Gemara that was printed in the DP camps in 1948, 1947. And they had a full Talmud of it, and it's worth $10,000. And they thought I came, you know, see that. I mean, it's nice, but it's not that exciting. But they did have a lot of his old stuff, and I found the catalog of his, where he had his sfarim written down. He was a collector, but not a thing in his collection was really first prints, first editions. Nothing very exciting like that. He had like a lot of sfarim, but none of them like, you know, that were a collector's item. So that got me thinking that maybe it never was in his collection. And that maybe he saw it in someone else's collection. So I started looking at the academic libraries around California, and we found one academic library that had a first print, Crazy Placey. That was UCLA. And guess what? That is the one. Okay? And if you could see right there, so I found it with someone else. We did it, worked on it together. And he published an article that, and it's very hard to see, but you can see, one thing you can't see over there in the middle is that it's a modern script. It says Yenis Nadishitz. It's a modern script. What I mean by modern script is that pre the innovation of continuously flowing ink, right? You'd write a certain style because every, right, if you have a feather and a quill, right? You'd have to dip your feather into the ink well and then write. So you'd be very sparing in your ink, right? You'd write a letter every, and you'd lift up the pen or the ink or the quill to minimize the amount of ink that you're using. However, once the innovation came where the ink was inside the pen and it was flowing, so you would start writing more continuous, right? And the way you delineate letters was by trying to, like, you know, be more scriptive. Mm-hmm. So after the flowing ink innovation, which was in the mid 1850s, the script became a lot more like this, like more, you know, and you can see that that's a script from that. And on the bottom, you see an older style, right? There are no, it's not continuous. It's written, you can tell, by a quill with an inkwell. Now, the person who went and published this, he said, we found it, but it's not Rabbi Snavishitz who wrote the Sefer, right? Which is an important piece of this puzzle, right? It's another Rabbi Snavishitz who lived 100 years ago, who happened to have the same name. And therefore, your answer is that Rabbi Snavishitz fixed it himself, and therefore the Sefer is wrong. Yeah, no, it was a different person. It happens to be named Rabbi Snavishitz. Just because he has that name doesn't give him any special insight or special rights to go and edit Rabbi Snavishitz, the Nasanata of Prague or Ahu. Okay? So that is where things stood until this article. And I want to show you that, okay, I can't really show it to you. I can maybe blow it up a little bit, but you're not going to be able to fully see it. Okay, on the top between Sefer and Krasia Plesi, that's where it says Yanis Nabashitz of Leshitz. Okay, it says it. So the obvious, and I happen to have found in Rabbi Neches's collection a Sefer written by Rabbi Nabashitz of Leshitz. So Rabbi Neches knew that he wanted Rabbi Nabashitz of Leshitz. So why is he writing that he has Sefer Krasia Plesi of Rabbi Nabashitz? Okay. That was the implication. Rabbi Dunner publicly said that he just doesn't think that Rabbi Neches was being fully forthcoming. But if you look on, again, it's on the middle toward the left, there's another writing of Yanis Nabashitz, okay? So the top, that's the top, and that's the middle, okay? Now, you can tell they're two different handwritings. That much you can tell. You can also tell that one is a more modern one, and you can also tell one is an older one. This right here is from a letter, a receipt that was signed by Rabbi Nabashitz when he was Rav of Metz. And this is in the Metz archives, the Library of Metz archives of the Jewish community. There's a receipt of his money, of money that he received. And it's signed Yanis Nabashitz, and that is Yanis Nabashitz of the Mechaber of Sefer Krasia Plesi. Tell me,
it's very simple.
Is that the same one?
He is the same. It's hard to tell from the sub, but that's not, that's a little bit, but it's not complete proof.
Yeah. How about that?
The hay, just the hay. You can't really prove much.
The yud, the hay.
The sub is too vague to tell.
So think about this, okay? Maybe it's not perfect, but what do you think the odds are of two young Spanish with that script?
The hay was done with a quill, not by a pen.
No, the one on the top and the one on the bottom. The one at the top is 100% Yanis Nabashitz, and the one at the bottom is on the char block of this sefer. I think that it's pretty close.
And who else would have done it?
So there are two Yanis on the same
page. Well, that's obvious. There are two Yanis on the same page because there are two handwritings that say Yanis Nabashitz on the same page. One's an older handwriting, one's a newer handwriting. That's clear. But what are the odds that there's a third Rabbi Nabashitz? In other words, forget that. Let me put it differently. If there was never any Yanis and Ibishitz of Leshitz, it never existed, okay? And it just said Yanis and Ibishitz in that script, what would you think? I would think that's Yanis and Ibishitz from Chabur, the Sefer. There's only 800 of them printed.
If there's only one person in the name Yanis and Ibishitz and the name Yanis and Ibishitz, yeah, we assume it's that person. But there's more than one Yanis and Ibishitz, right? So we don't really know.
Right. There's more than
right.
One.
It's very
there's more
it's
than one
argument.
I don't think
this would work in a court of law.
Okay. So the question is, what standard are we dealing with? There's a civil standard, more likely than not. I think it meets that. There's another standard called clear and compelling. I think it does meet that. Then there's another standard, which is to put someone in jail, which is beyond all reasonable doubt. I don't think it meets that standard. But I do think it meets the civil standard. That's my opinion. And the correction which is made, also important, where it says Sefer Hilchos Nikur, is also an old script,
right.
And it looks to be a very similar script to this script. I can't say.
Can it be the major?
Oh, it looks like Samach HaYinyon.
Seder, no, that's Samach HaYinyon.
It's printed. Yeah, but the key
over here is we're not going to Rabbi Dunham.
What?
We're just not going to Rabbi Dunham. This actually backs up
correct. In other words, even if you wish to disagree, there is clearly enough evidence that in good faith, Rabbi Neches, in good faith, made a determination that it is Rabbi Neches, the Mechaber. I think there's definitely enough for that. Okay. So the counter argument is about Occam's razor, which is, again, it's not when there's evidence, it's just the idea that if you have two possible interpretations, you should go with the more simple one. But if there's evidence for the, now what's really fascinating is that I was actually totally wrong about my logic of finding it in UCLA. It actually came to UCLA from Israel as part of the Bamberger-Warman collection. So my entire logic is completely not true. I have to say that, because that was my thought process, but the thought process is not true. It somehow got to Israel. I don't know how, okay? And in the 1970s, a woman by the name of Mrs. Cummings, Theodore E. Cummings, was their husband. Her husband died, and she donated 60,000 books, Sfarim, to UCLA. I just don't understand it. It's in Israel. People can speak the language. People don't learn it. It's available. So in honor of your husband, you take the books and you give it to a university where nobody is going to look at it for the next 100 years. I don't understand what the honor in that is. Her son actually was appointed. I guess that's the reason. Her son was appointed ambassador to Austria in the Reagan administration. So, I guess that's what people do that have kids that are ambassadors. They buy sperm collections and donate it to university libraries.
So the second Rabbi Nisamishitz.
What do we do? Sorry?
So the second Rabbi Nisamishitz obtained the Sefer written by the and corrected by the first Rabbi Nisamishitz, signed his own name for some reason.
Well, it's his Sefer. But he wrote the Nisamishitz of Leshitz. In his
Leshitz.
He says it from Leshitz. He doesn't say from, you know.
No. He says from Leshitz. Oh, but he was just signing his name. It's mine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Leshem, Arutz, and Loya. You know, that's it for
okay.
The Sifre,
we used to do in school. We put our initials
to their names.
Do
you have
to
denote Hilchos Nikur?
Sorry. Oh, okay. Hilchos Nikur. So let's talk about Hilchos Nikur.
No, I mean, you're trying to prove something.
The correction.
I mean,
you found
the correct,
Okay, so again, okay, so there is no Sefer with the exact title of Hilchos Nikur. Sefer Hilchos Nikur. Okay. However, there is a Sefer, and I wanted to talk about this, that is very close and actually would answer the original question I asked, why does this Menacher accept this source, okay? And the title of the Sefer, where it says it clearly, that it's Megum Tzchar Nekevis, is called, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the Valmadana Trust, because that's close to my heart. So there was a someone by the name of Jack Lunzer, who lived in London. He died 7 years ago. And he had built up this incredible collection of Sfarim. It's called the Valmadana Trust. And the star of the Valmadana Trust was the Shas published by Daniel Bamberg that was in pristine, untouched condition. And he wanted his, and also he had every single sefer published in Italy in his collection. And he wanted to sell it because he needed the money. He wasn't that wealthy. He was wealthy, but not that wealthy. And he needed the money, and he wanted to sell it as a collection because he wanted that to be his legacy. That it's you know, scholars can go and, you know, he had a complete collection, and he wanted to sell it as a complete collection. And Sotheby's did a magnificent job in 2009 trying to sell it. They did this wonderful display, and nobody stepped up to buy it. I think they wanted $14 million. And no one was willing to buy it. And the condition was that it would be sold together. His dying wish was that it should be sold together. His heirs did not do it, and they ended up selling the Shas separately for, I think, $7 or $8 or $9 million to Leon Black. And he told me, I went to visit him in London, he told me the following story of how he collected this Shas. So here goes the story, and we'll end with that. I'm sorry that I took a little extra time. But so this sefer, before I get to the story, the sefer is Shchitus of Yaakovel. It's called Seder HaNikur. It's not called Seder Hilchus Nikur, it's Seder HaNikur. But Yaakovel was a Rishon, or late Rishon. And it says on this, the title, HaGoyis HaChidushim Shalikit V'Asaf, HaRab Tzvi V'Rab Yitzchak Yaakov. And he added onto it halachos. And there was an added on to the sefer, the halachos of Tzvi V'Yitzchak Yaakov, which is never published anywhere again or before. It's only claim to fame. And this is why it's important. Mashabal Yodu Bodak Nasal Zekamashanin, V'Hoyga Ois V'Ois, Alpi Mariner of Moshe Isilis, Ben Hirsch Ben Yitzchak Yaakov Mikraka. And that is why this had the guy creating the problem, you know, checkmated. Because these halachos were from Ramah, who was the Paisik of the Ashkenazi Kehillis, and Rebbeinu Eibishitz showed him in Seder HaNikur that the Ramah paskin that it's on Tzchar Menikevis, and that is what gave this Menaker pause and to stop his agitation.
The Ramah
paskins like this. It's in this sefer. Yeah. He says that it goes in Tzchamim came to animals, yeah.
And it means animals, not people.
And it means animals, not people. It's a practical guide to being menacher. Like, you have like these practical guides that are someone puts together a leak of practical halachas. So, the, you know, the how-to guide for Tisha B'Av, right? So there's svarim that are the big picture, theory of it. And there are certain svarim which are practical. And this was a practical sefer that the people that were involved in Nikur used. So that's why he accepted it as authoritative. I just want to tell you the story that Jack Lunzer told me about how he acquired the Shas from Daniel Bamberg in pristine condition. And this is how it goes. He knew that the Westminster Abbey had a set of Bamberg Shas. And he approached them to purchase it. And they would not hear from it at all, ever. And he actually got to see it. And he saw that it was literally untouched, straight out of the box. It was printed in the 1520s. So we're talking about 500 years, 480 years at the time, and it was literally straight out of the box. Nobody touched it. You can find Bamberg Gemaras at auction for a substantial amount of money, obviously, but they're all used, and obviously the more used Gemaras are impossible to find. You cannot find above Nasi or Rava Kama. You can find the Zvachim and Nachas. You could. Because people used them, you know, that was the thing. Initially there was no demand. Gutenberg had a tough time selling his Bible because, think about it, it's really strange. Gutenberg had a tough time selling his Bible because at that time, the only demand for books were religious books, and the Christians had monasteries where priests would write all day, and it was free labor. There was no shortage of books that the Christians wanted. It was only, so then they decided to try to do it. There was tremendous demand for the Jewish market. And in fact, in 1243, when they burnt the Gemaras in Paris after the disputation in Paris in 1241, there was, according to many sources, 10,000 scrolls were burned. 10,000. And we're not talking about big Jewish communities. There was a big demand and it was very painstaking, and we didn't have people that were copying Gemaras. So then they decided to start printing. It sounds strange, but you know what? When they were laying telegraph wires from Texas to New York, Henry David Thoreau writes that, you know, they're stupid. They really are. They're spending all these millions of dollars laying telegraph wires from Texas to New York. Did they ever think that maybe in Texas there's nobody that wants to talk to anyone in New York? So it was the same kind of process about books, because there's so many books. You know, today it's a okay, but the so then Daniel Blumberg, who was actually not Jewish, decided to do a shas, and with that and sell it, and actually did well. So the early printing, a lot of it was Jewish printing, because there was a tremendous demand for it, and it was expensive, and the Jews were able to put the money together and they would sacrifice for it. So going back to Bamberg, how did it end up in Westminster Abbey? So an incredible story. Henry VIII was king of England, okay? And he married his first wife was?
Adam Boyle.
No, it was the second wife. His first wife was Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon was the daughter of Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, Yimach Shemam B'Zichron. They still burn in Gehenna. Now she, interesting story. She was betrothed to Henry VIII's older brother, Arthur. He was sick, and they got married. But he died 5 months after the marriage. And she claimed that it was never consummated. So the question was, everyone, it says in the Torah, it says in the Bible that you can't marry your brother's wife. And if that's the case, then he can't marry his brother Arthur's wife. But she tied it that it was only Menaeris and not Menaeris Stuart, because it was not consummated. So he sent for a Gemara, because they talk about it in Givamas. He said, maybe the Jews will have an answer that will help them, because he wanted to divorce her. But actually, had he got the Gemara in time, it wouldn't have helped him, because you do fall to Yibum, even from the Harrison. But what ended up happening? What ended up happening is by the time he got it, it was irrelevant, because he wanted the Pope to do an annulment.
Yes.
Now, the popes in this era were not very, honest. They needed money, and they were dishonest, and they would sell forgiveness. And when you had all your sins forgiven, they were out of luck. They were out of money. So what they came up with, an innovation that they can forgive you for sins in the future, and they started making money on that. So the question became, why didn't the Pope just give him his annulment?
That's political.
Yes, it's political. So Catherine of Aragon's sister was named Joanna. She was the older child. And her son was named Charles V. Charles V was the most powerful king in England, in Europe. He inherited Spain through his mother, and he inherited Germany and the Holy Roman Empire from his father. And he had as his prisoner the Pope. So the king of England wasn't getting anything from the Pope, because Catherine of Aragon, who was trying to divorce, or have an annul, is actually the aunt of the king who's holding the Pope prisoner. So that wasn't going to happen. So he ended up forming his own church, the Anglican church, and that's how the split happened. But the time the Gemara got there, there was no interest, so he donated it to Westminster Abbey, and that's where it sat. And Jack Lunzer was able to acquire it, because he found at auction the actual charter which established Westminster Abbey. Somehow they didn't have it. He bought it for $1 million at auction, and then he went and traded it with them for the shots. They were very happy to make that trade. And that's how we acquired it. Thank you all for listening.